Mr. Micawber had finished. He said with exceeding gravity, "Pardon me," and proceeded with a mixture of the lowest spirits and the most intense enjoyment to the peroration of his litter. "I have now concluded. It merely remains for me to substantiate these accusations, and then, with my ill-starred family, to disappear from the landscape on which we appear to be an encumbrance. That is soon done. It may be reasonably inferred that our baby will first expire of inanition, as being the frailest member of our circle, and that our twins will follow next in order. So be it. For myself, my Canterbury pilgrimage has done much. Imprisonment on civil process and want will soon do more. I trust that the labour and hazard of an investigation, of which the smallest results have been slowly pieced together in the pressure of arduous avocations, under grinding pecuniary apprehensions at rise of morn, at dewy eve, in the shadows of night, under the watchful eye of one whom it were superfluous to call demon, combined with the struggle of parental poverty to turn it, when completed, to the right account, maybe as the sprinkling of a few drops of sweet water on my funereal pyre. I ask no more. Let it be in justice merely said of me, as of a gallant and eminent naval hero, with whom I have no pretensions to cope, that what I have done, I did, in despite of mercenary and selfish objects, for England, home, and beauty. Remaining always, etc., etc., Wilkins Micawber." Much affected, but still intensely enjoying himself, Mr. Micawber folded up his letter and handed it with a bow to my aunt, as something she might like to keep. There was, as I had noticed on my first visit long ago, an iron safe in the room. The key was in it. A hasty suspicion seemed to strike Uriah, and, with a glance at Mr. Micawber, he went to it and threw the doors, clanking open. It was empty. "Where are the books?" he cried with a frightful face. "Some thief has stolen the books!" Mr. Micawber tapped himself with the ruler. "I did, when I got the key from you as usual, but a little earlier, and opened it this morning." "Don't be uneasy," said Traddles. "They've come into my possession. I'll take care of them under the authority I mentioned." "You receive stolen goods, do you?" cried Uriah. "Under such circumstances," answered Traddles, "yes." What was my astonishment when I beheld my aunt, who had been profoundly quiet and attentive, make a dart at Uriah Heep and seize him by the collar with both hands. "You know what I want," said my aunt. "A straight waistcoat," said he. "No, my property," returned my aunt. "Agnes, my dear, as long as I believed it had been really made away with by your father, I wouldn't. And, my dear, I didn't even to Trot, as he knows, breathe a syllable of its having been placed here for investment. But now I know this fellow's answerable for it, and I'll have it. Trot, come and take it away from him." Whether my aunt supposed for the moment that he kept her property in his neckerchief, I'm sure I don't know, but she certainly pulled at it as if she thought so. I hastened to put myself between them, and to assure her that we would all take care that he should make the utmost restitution of everything he had wrongly got. This, and a few moments' reflection, pacified her. But she was not at all disconcerted by what she'd done, though I cannot say as much for her bonnet, and resumed her seat composedly. During the last few minutes, Mrs. Heep had been clamouring to her son to be humble, and had been going down on her knees to all of us in succession and making the wildest promises. Her son sat her down in his chair, and standing sulkily by her, holding her arm with his hand, but not rudely, said to me, with a ferocious look, "What do you want done?" "I will tell you what must be done," said Traddles. "Has that Copperfield no tongue? muttered Uriah. "I would do a good deal for you if you could tell me without lying that somebody had cut it out."
"My Uriah means to be humble," cried his mother. "Don't mind what he says, good gentleman."
"What must be done," said Traddles, "is this. First, the deed of relinquishment that we've heard of must be given over to me now. Here." "Suppose I haven't got it," he interrupted. "But you have," said Traddles. "Therefore, you know, we won't suppose so." And I cannot help avowing that this was the first occasion on which I really did justice to the clear head and the plain, patient, practical good sense of my old schoolfellow. "Then," said Traddles, "you must prepare to disgorge all that your rapacity has become possessed of, and to make restoration to the last farthing. All the partnership books and papers must remain in our possession, all your books and papers, all money accounts and securities of both kinds, in short, everything here."
"Must it?"
"I don't know that," said Uriah. "I must have time to think about that."
"Certainly," replied Traddles. "But in the meanwhile, and until everything is done to our satisfaction, we shall maintain possession of these things, and beg you, in short, compel you, to keep your own room and hold no communication with anyone."
"I won't do it," said Uriah with an oath.
"Maidstone Jail is a safer place of detention," observed Traddles. "And though the law may be longer in writing us, and may not be able to write us so completely as you can, there is no doubt of its punishing you. Dear me, you know that quite as well as I. Copperfield, will you go round to the Guildhall and bring a couple of officers?" Here Mrs. Heap broke out again, crying on her knees to Agnes to interfere in their behalf, exclaiming that he was very humble, and it was all true, and if he didn't do what we wanted, she would, and much more to the same purpose, being half frantic with fears for her darling. To inquire what he might have done if he'd had any boldness would be like inquiring what a mongrel cur might do if it had the spirit of a tiger. He was a coward from head to foot, and showed his dastardly nature through his sullenness and mortification as much as at any time of his mean life.
"Stop!" he growled to me, and wiped his hot face with his hand. "Mother! Hold your noise. Well, let him have that deed. Go and fetch it."
"Do you help her, Mr. Dick," said Traddles, "if you please."
Proud of his commission and understanding it, Mr. Dick accompanied her, as a shepherd's dog might accompany a sheep. But Mrs. Heap gave him little trouble, for she not only returned with the deed, but with the box in which it was, where we found a banker's book, and some other papers that were afterwards serviceable.
"Good," said Traddles, when this was brought. "Now, Mr. Heap, you can retire to think. Particularly observing, if you please, that I declare to you, on the part of all present, that there is only one thing to be done, that it is what I have explained, and that it must be done without delay."
Uriah, without lifting his eyes from the ground, shuffled across the room with his hand to his chin, and pausing at the door said, "Copperfield, I have always hated you. You've always been an upstart, and you've always been against me."
"As I think I told you once before," said I, "it is you who have been in your greed and cunning against all the world. It may be profitable to you to reflect in future that there never were greed and cunning in the world yet that didn't do too much and overreach themselves. It is as certain as death, or as certain as they used to teach at school. The same school where I picked up so much humbleness, from 9 o'clock to 11, that labour was a curse, and from 11 o'clock to 1 that it was a blessing and a cheerfulness and a dignity, and I don't know what all, eh?" said he with a sneer. "You preach about as consistent as they did. Won't humbleness go down? I shouldn't have got round my gentleman fellow partners without it, I think. Micawber, you old bully, I'll pay you!"
Mr. Micawber, supremely defiant of him and his extended finger, and making a great deal of his chest until he had slunk out at the door, then addressed himself to me,
and proffered me the satisfaction of witnessing the re-establishment of mutual confidence between himself and Mrs. Micawber. After which he invited the company generally to the contemplation of that affecting spectacle. The veil that has long been interposed between Mrs. Micawber and myself is now withdrawn, said Mr. Micawber, and my children and the author of their being can once more come in contact on equal terms. As we were all very grateful to him, and all desirous to show that we were, as well as the hurry and disorder of our spirits would permit, I dare say we should all have gone, but that it was necessary for Agnes to return to her father, as yet unable to bear more than the dawn of hope, and for someone else to hold Uriah in safe keeping. So Traddles remained for the latter purpose, to be presently relieved by Mr. Dick, and Mr. Dick, my aunt and I, went home with Mr. Micawber. As I parted hurriedly from the dear girl to whom I owed so much, and thought, from what she'd been saved, perhaps that morning, her better resolution notwithstanding, I felt devoutly thankful for the miseries of my younger days which had brought me to the knowledge of Mr. Micawber. His house was not far off, and as the street door opened into the sitting-room, and he bolted in with a precipitation quite his own, we found ourselves at once in the bosom of the family. Mr. Micawber exclaiming, "Emma, my life!" rushed into Mrs. Micawber's arms. Mrs. Micawber shrieked and folded Mr. Micawber in her embrace. Miss Micawber, nursing the unconscious stranger of Mrs. Micawber's last letter to me, was sensibly affected. The stranger leapt. The twins testified their joy by several inconvenient but innocent demonstrations. Master Micawber, whose disposition appeared to have been soured by early disappointment and whose aspect had become morose, yielded to his better feelings and blubbered. "Emma," said Mr. Micawber, "the cloud is passed from my mind. Mutual confidence, so long preserved between us, once is restored to know no further interruption. Now, welcome, poverty," cried Mr. Micawber, shedding tears. "Welcome, misery! Welcome, houselessness! Welcome, hunger, rags, tempest, and beggary! Mutual confidence will sustain us to the end."
This ends side one of cassette 24. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
With these expressions, Mr. Micawber placed Mrs. Micawber in a chair and embraced the family all round, welcoming a variety of bleak prospects which appeared, to the best of my judgment, to be anything but welcome to them, and calling upon them to come out into Canterbury and sing a chorus as nothing else was left for their support. But Mrs. Micawber, having in the strength of her emotions fainted away, the first thing to be done, even before the chorus could be considered complete, was to recover her. This my aunt and Mr. Micawber did, and then my aunt was introduced, and Mrs. Micawber recognised me. "Excuse me, dear Mr. Copperfield," said the poor lady, giving me her hand, "but I'm not strong, and the removal of the late misunderstanding between Mr. Micawber and myself was at first too much for me." "Is this all your family, ma'am?" said my aunt. "There are no more at present," returned Mrs. Micawber. "Good gracious, I didn't mean that, ma'am," said my aunt. "I mean, are all these yours?" "Madam," replied Mr. Micawber, "it is a true bill." "And that eldest young gentleman now," said my aunt, musing, "what has he been brought up to?" "It was my hope when I came here," said Mr. Micawber, "to have got Wilkins into the church, or perhaps I shall express my meaning more strictly if I say the choir. But there was no vacancy for the tenor in the venerable pile for which this city is so justly eminent, and he has, in short, he's contracted a habit of singing in public houses rather than in sacred edifices." "But he means well," said Mrs. Micawber tenderly.
"I dare say, my love," rejoined Mr. Micawber, "that he means particularly well, but I have not yet found that he carries out his meaning in any given direction whatsoever."
Master Micawber's moroseness of aspect returned upon him again, and he demanded with some temper, what was he to do? whether he'd been born a carpenter or a coach painter any more than he'd been born a bird. Whether he could go into the next street and open a chemist's shop. Whether he could rush to the next assizes and proclaim himself a lawyer. Whether he could come out by force at the opera and succeed by violence. Whether he could do anything without being brought up to something. My aunt mused a little while and then said, "Mr. McCormick, I wonder you've never turned your thoughts to emigration." "Madam," returned Mr. Micawber, "it was the dream of my youth and the fallacious aspiration of my riper years." I'm thoroughly persuaded, by the by, that he'd never thought of it in his life. "Aye," said my aunt, with a glance at me. "Why, what a thing it would be for yourselves and your family, Mr. and Mrs. Micawber, if you were to emigrate now."
"Capital, madam.
Capital," urged Mr. Micawber gloomily. "That is the principal, I may say the only difficulty, my dear Mr. Copperfield," assented his wife. "Capital," cried my aunt. "But you're doing us a great service, have done us a great service, I may say, for surely much will come out of the fire. And what could we do for you that would be half so good as to find the capital?"
"I could not receive it as a gift," said Mr. Micawber, full of fire and animation. "But if a sufficient sum could be advanced, say at 5% interest per annum upon my personal liability, say my notes of hand at 12, 18, and 24 months respectively, to allow time for something to turn up, could be, can be, and shall be on your own terms," returned my aunt, "if you say the word. Think of this now, both of you. Here are some people David knows going out to Australia shortly. If you decide to go, why shouldn't you go in the same ship? You may help each other. Think of this now, Mr. and Mrs. Micawber. Take your time and weigh it well." "There is but one question, my dear ma'am, I could wish to ask," said Mrs. Micawber. "The climate, I believe, is healthy." "Finest in the world," said my aunt. "Just so," returned Mrs. Micawber. "Then my question arises. Now, are the circumstances of the country such that a man of Mr. Micawber's abilities would have a fair chance of rising in the social scale?" "I will not say at present, my dear Spartanby, governor, or anything of that sort, but would there be a reasonable opening for his talents to develop themselves that would be amply sufficient and find their own expansion?" "No better opening anywhere," said my aunt, "for a man who conducts himself well and is industrious." "For a man who conducts himself well," repeated Mrs. Micawber with her clearest business manner, "and is industrious. Precisely. It is evident to me that Australia is the legitimate sphere of action for Mr. Micawber. I entertain the conviction, my dear madam," said Mr. Micawber, "that it is, under existing circumstances, the land, the only land for myself and family, and that something of an extraordinary nature will turn up on that shore. It is no distance, comparatively speaking, and though consideration is due to the kindness of your proposal, I assure you that is a mere matter of form." Shall I ever forget how, in a moment, he was the most sanguine of men looking on to fortune, or how Mrs. Micawber presently discoursed about the habits of the kangaroo? Shall I ever recall that street of Canterbury on a market day without recalling him as he walked back with us, expressing in the hardy, roving manner he assumed the unsettled habits of a temporary sojourner in the land, and looking at the bullocks as they came by with the eye of an Australian farmer? Chapter 53, Another Retrospect. I must pause yet once again. Oh, my child wife, there is a figure in the moving crowd before my memory, quiet and still, saying, in its innocent love and childish beauty, "Stop to think of me. Turn to look upon the little blossom as it flutters to the ground." I do. All else grows dim and fades away. I am again with Dora in our cottage.
I don't know how long she's been ill. I'm so used to it in feeling that I cannot count the time. It's not really long in weeks or months, but in my usage and experience it is a weary, weary while. They've left off telling me to wait a few days more. I've begun to fear remotely that the day may never shine when I shall see my child wife running in the sunlight with her old friend Jip. He is, as it were, suddenly grown very old. It may be that he misses in his mistress something that enlivened him and made him younger, but he mopes, and his sight is weak and his limbs are feeble, and my aunt is sorry that he objects to her no more, but creeps near her as he lies on Dora's bed. She's sitting at the bedside, and mildly licks her hand. Dora lies smiling on us, and is beautiful, and utters no hasty or complaining word. She says that we're very good to her, that her dear old careful boy is tiring himself out, she knows, that my aunt has no sleep, yet is always wakeful, active, and kind. Sometimes the little bird-like ladies come to see her, and then we talk about our wedding day and all that happy time. What a strange rest and pause in my life there seems to be, and in all life, with indoors and without, when I sit in a quiet, shaded, orderly room, with the blue eyes of my child wife turned towards me, and her little fingers twining round my hand. Many and many an hour I sit thus. But of all those times, three times come the freshest on my mind. It is morning, and Dora, made so trim by my aunt's hands, shows me how her pretty hair will curl upon the pillow yet, and how long and bright it is, and how she likes to have it loosely gathered in that net she wears. "Not that I'm vain of it now, you mocking boy," she says, when I smile, "but because you used to say you thought it so beautiful, and because when I first began to think about you I used to peep in the glass and wonder whether you would like very much to have a lock of it. Oh, what a foolish fellow you were, Dodie, when I gave you one." "That was on the day when you were painting the flowers I'd given you, Dora, and when I told you how much in love I was." "Oh, but I didn't like to tell you," says Dora then, "how I had cried over them because I believed you really liked me. When I can run about again as I used to do, Dodie, let's go and see those places where we were such a silly couple, shall we, and take some of the old walks, and not forget poor Papa." "Yes, we will, and have some happy days. So you must make haste to get well, my dear." "Oh, and I shall soon do that. I'm so much better, you don't know." It is evening, and I sit in the same chair, by the same bed, with the same face turned towards me. We've been silent, and there is a smile upon her face. I have ceased to carry my light burden up and downstairs now. She lies here all the day. "Dodie, my dear Dora, you won't think what I'm going to say unreasonable after what you told me such a little while ago of Mr. Wickfield's not being well. I want to see Agnes. Very much I want to see her."
"I'll write to her, my dear."
"Will you?"
"Directly."
"What a good, kind boy. Dodie, take me on your arm. Indeed, my dear, it's not a whim, it's not a foolish fancy. I want very much indeed to see her."
"I'm certain of it. I have only to tell her so, and she's sure to come."
"You're very lonely when you go downstairs now,"
Dora whispers with her arm about my neck. "How can I be otherwise, my own love, when I see your empty chair?"
"My empty chair."
She clings to me for a little while in silence.
"And you really miss me, Dodie?"
Looking up and brightly smiling.
"Even poor, giddy, stupid me. My heart, who is there upon earth that I could miss so much?" "Oh, husband, I'm so glad, yet so sorry."
Creeping closer to me, and folding me in both her arms. She laughs and sobs, and then is quiet and quite happy.
"Quite,"
she says.
"Only give Agnes my dear love, and tell her that I want very, very much to see her, and I have nothing left to wish for.
Except to get well again, Dora.
Oh, Dodie. Sometimes I think... You know, I always was a silly little thing. But that will never be.
Don't say so, Dora. Dearest love, don't think so.
I won't if I can help it, Dodie. But I am very happy.
Though my dear boy is so lonely by himself before his child wife's empty chair. It is night. And I'm with her still. Agnes has arrived. Has been among us for a whole day and an evening. She, my aunt, and I have sat with Dora since the morning all together. We've not talked much, but Dora has been perfectly contented and cheerful. We are now alone. Do I know now that my child wife will soon leave me? They've told me so. They've told me nothing new to my thoughts. But I am far from sure that I have taken that truth to heart. I cannot master it. I have withdrawn by myself many times today to weep. I've remembered who wept for a parting between the living and the dead. I have bethought me of all that gracious and compassionate history. I have tried to resign myself and to console myself, and that, I hope, I may have done imperfectly. But what I cannot firmly settle in my mind is that the end will absolutely come. I hold her hand in mine. I hold her heart in mine. I see her love for me alive in all its strength. I cannot shut out a pale, lingering shadow of belief that she will be spared.
I'm going to speak to you, Dodie. I'm going to say something I've often thought of saying lately. You won't mind?
With a gentle look.
Mind, my darling. Because I don't know what you will think or what you may have thought sometimes. Perhaps you've often thought the same. Dodie dear, I'm afraid I was too young.
I lay my face upon the pillow by her and she looks into my eyes and speaks very softly. Gradually, as she goes on, I feel with a stricken heart that she is speaking of herself as past.
I'm afraid, dear, I was too young. I don't mean in years only, but in experience and thoughts and everything. I was such a silly little creature.
I'm afraid it would have been better if we had only loved each other
as a boy and girl. And forgotten it. I have begun to think I was not fit to be a wife.
I try to stay my tears and to reply, Oh, Dora, love, as fit as I to be a husband.
I don't know.
With the old shake of her curls,
perhaps. But if I had been more fit to be married, I might have made you more so, too. Besides, you are very clever, and I never was. We've been very happy, my sweet Dora. I was very happy, very. But as years went on, my dear boy would have wearied of his child wife. She would have been less and less a companion for him. He would have been more and more sensible of what was wanting in his home. She wouldn't have improved. It is better as it is.
Oh, Dora, dearest, dearest. Don't speak to me so. Every word seems a reproach.
No, not a syllable.
She answers, kissing me.
Oh, my dear, you never deserved it, and I loved you far too well to say a reproachful word to you in earnest. It was all the merit I had except being pretty. Or you thought me so. Is it lonely downstairs, Dodie?
Very. Very.
Don't cry. Is my chair there?
In its old place.
Oh, how my poor boy cries. Hush, hush. Now, make me one promise. I want to speak to Agnes. When you go downstairs, tell Agnes so and send her up to me. and while I speak to her, let no one come, not even Aunt. I want to speak to Agnes by herself. I want to speak to Agnes quite alone. I promise that she shall immediately, but I cannot leave her for my grief. I said that it was better as it is, she whispers, as she holds me in her arms. Oh, Dodie, after more years you never could have loved your child wife better than you do, and after more years she would so have tried and disappointed you that you might not have been able to love her half so well. I know I was too young and foolish. It's much better as it is.
Agnes is downstairs when I go into the parlour, and I give her the message. She disappears, leaving me alone with Jip. His Chinese house is by the fire, and he lies within it on his bed of flannel, querulously trying to sleep. The bright moon is high and clear. As I look out on the night, my tears fall fast, and my undisciplined heart is chastened heavily. Heavily. I sit down by the fire, thinking with a blind remorse of all those secret feelings I've nourished since my marriage. I think of every little trifle between me and Dora, and feel the truth that trifles make the sum of life. Ever rising from the sea of my remembrance is the image of the dear child as I knew her first, graced by my young love and by her own, with every fascination wherein such love is rich. Would it indeed have been better if we'd loved each other as a boy and a girl and forgotten it? Undisciplined heart reply. How the time wears, I know not, until I am recalled by my child wife's old companion. More restless than he was, he crawls out of his house and looks at me and wanders to the door and whines to go upstairs. Not tonight, Chip. Not tonight. He comes very slowly back to me, licks my hand, and lifts his dim eyes to my face. Oh, Jip, it may be never again. He lies down at my feet, stretches himself out as if to sleep, and with a plaintive cry, is dead.
Oh, Agnes, look. Look here.
That face, so full of pity and of grief, that rain of tears, that awful mute appeal to me, that solemn hand upraised towards heaven.
Agnes?
It is over. Darkness comes before my eyes, and for a time all things are blotted out of my remembrance. Chapter 54. Mr. Micawber's Transactions. This is not the time at which I am to enter on the state of my mind beneath its load of sorrow. I came to think that the future was walled up before me, that the energy and action of my life were at an end, that I never could find any refuge but in the grave. I came to think so, I say, but not in the first shock of my grief. It slowly grew to that. If the events I go on to relate had not thickened around me, in the beginning to confuse, and in the end to augment my affliction, it is possible, though I think not probable, that I might have fallen at once into this condition. As it was, an interval occurred before I fully knew my own distress, an interval in which I even supposed that its sharpest pangs were past, and when my mind could soothe itself by resting on all that was most innocent and beautiful in the tender story that was closed for ever. When it was first proposed that I should go abroad, or how it came to be agreed among us that I was to seek the restoration of my peace in change and travel, I do not, even now, distinctly know. The spirit of Agnes so pervaded all we thought and said and did in that time of sorrow, that I assume I may refer the project to her influence, but her influence was so quiet that I know no more. And now, indeed, I began to think that, in my old association of her with the stained-glass window in the church, a prophetic foreshadowing of what she would be to me in the calamity that was to happen in the fullness of time had found a way into my mind. In all that sorrow, from the moment never to be forgotten, when she stood before me with her upraised hand, she was like a sacred presence in my lonely house. When the angel of death alighted there, my child wife fell asleep, they told me so when I could bear to hear it, on her bosom with a smile. From my swoon I first awoke to a consciousness of her compassionate tears, her words of hope and peace, her gentle face bending down as from a purer region, nearer heaven, over my undisciplined heart, and softening its pain. Let me go on. I was to go abroad. That seemed to have been determined among us from the first. The ground now covering all that could perish of my departed wife, I waited only for what Mr. Micawber called the final pulverization of heap, and for the departure of the emigrants. At the request of Traddles, most affectionate and devoted of friends in my trouble, we returned to Canterbury. I mean my aunt, Agnes, and I. We proceeded by appointment straight to Mr. Micawber's house, where, and at Mr. Wickfield's, my friend had been labouring ever since our explosive meeting. When poor Mrs. Micawber saw me come in my black clothes, she was sensibly affected. There was a great deal of good in Mrs. Micawber's heart, which had not been dunned out of it in all those many years. "Well, Mr. and Mrs. Micawber," was my aunt's first salutation after we were seated. "Pray, have you thought about that emigration proposal of mine?" "My dear madam," returned Mr. Micawber, "perhaps I cannot better express the conclusion at which Mrs. Micawber, your humble servant, and I may add our children, have jointly and severally arrived, than by borrowing the language of an illustrious poet to reply that our boat is on the shore and our bark is on the sea." "That's right," said my aunt. "I augur all sorts of good from your sensible decision." "Madam, you do us a great deal of honour," he rejoined. He then referred to a memorandum. "With respect to the pecuniary assistance enabling us to launch our frail canoe on the ocean of enterprise, I have reconsidered that important business point, and would beg to propose my notes of hand, drawn, it is needless to stipulate, on stamps of the amounts respectively required by the various Acts of Parliament applying to such securities, at 18, 24, and 30 months. The proposition I originally submitted was 12, 18, and 24, but I am apprehensive that such an arrangement might not allow sufficient time for the requisite amount of something to turn up. We might not," said Mr. Micawber, looking round the room as if it represented several hundred acres of highly cultivated land, "on the first responsibility becoming due, have been successful in our harvest. Or we might not have got our harvest in. Labour, I believe, is sometimes difficult to obtain in that portion of our colonial possessions where it will be our lot to combat with the teeming soil." "Arrange it in any way you please, sir," said my aunt. "Madam," he replied, "Mrs. Micawber and myself are deeply sensible of the very considerate kindness of our friends and patrons. What I wish is to be perfectly businesslike and perfectly punctual, turning over, as we are about to turn over, an entirely new leaf, and falling back, as we are now in the act of falling back, for a spring of no common magnitude. It is important to my sense of self-respect, besides being an example to my son, that these arrangements should be concluded as between man and man." I don't know that Mr. Micawber attached any meaning to this last phrase. I don't know that anybody ever does or did, but he appeared to relish it uncommonly, and repeated with an impressive cough, "as between man and man." "I propose," said Mr. Micawber, "bills. convenience to the mercantile world, for which I believe we are originally indebted to the Jews, who appear to me to have had a devilish deal too much to do with them ever since, because they are negotiable. But if a bond or any other description of security would be preferred, I should be happy to execute any such instrument as between man and man. My aunt observed that in a case where both parties were willing to agree to anything, she took it for granted there would be no difficulty in settling this point. Mr. Micawber was of her opinion. In reference to our domestic preparations, madam, said Mr. Micawber with some pride, for meeting the destiny to which we are now understood to be self-devoted, I beg to report them. My eldest daughter attends at 5 every morning in a neighbouring establishment to acquire the process, if process it may be called, of milking cows. My younger children are instructed to observe, as closely as circumstances will permit, the habits of the pigs and poultry maintained in the poorer parts of this city, a pursuit from which they have on 2 occasions been brought home within an inch of being run over. I have myself directed some attention during the past week to the art of baking, and my son Wilkins has issued forth with a walking stick and driven cattle, when permitted by the rugged hirelings who had them in charge, to render any voluntary service in that direction, which I regret to say, for the credit of our nature, was not often, he being generally warned with imprecations to desist. All very right indeed, said my aunt encouragingly. Mrs. Micawber has been busy too, I have no doubt. My dear madam, returned Mrs. Micawber with her businesslike air, I am free to confess that I have not been actively engaged in pursuits immediately connected with cultivation or with stock, though well aware that both will claim my attention on a foreign shore. Such opportunities as I have been enabled to alienate from my domestic duties, I have devoted to corresponding at some length with my family. For I own it seems to me, my dear Mr. Copperfield, said Mrs. Micawber, who always fell back on me, I suppose, from old habit, to whomsoever else she might address her discourse at starting, that the time is come when the past should be buried in oblivion, when my family should take Mr. Micawber by the hand, and Mr. Micawber should take my family by the hand, when the lion should lie down with the lamb, and my family be on terms with Mr. Micawber. I said I thought so, too. This, at least, is the light, my dear Mr. Copperfield, pursued Mrs. Micawber, in which I view the subject. When I lived at home with my papa and mamma, my papa was accustomed to ask, when any point was under discussion in our limited circle, in what light does my Emma view the subject? That my papa was too partial, I know. Still, on such a point as the frigid coldness which ever subsisted between Mr. Micawber and my family, I necessarily have formed an opinion, delusive though it may be. No doubt. Of course you have none, said my aunt. Precisely so, assented Mrs. Micawber. Now, I may be wrong in my conclusions, it's very likely that I am, but my individual impression is that the gulf between my family and Mr. Micawber may be traced to an apprehension on the part of my family that Mr. Micawber would require pecuniary accommodation. I cannot help thinking, said Mrs. Micawber with an air of deep sagacity, that there are members of my family who have been apprehensive that Mr. Micawber would solicit them for their names. I don't mean to be conferred in baptism upon our children, but to be inscribed on bills of exchange and negotiated in the money market. The look of penetration with which Mrs. Micawber announced this discovery, as if no one had ever thought of it before, seemed rather to astonish my aunt, who abruptly replied, "Well, ma'am, upon the whole, I shouldn't wonder if you were right." Mr. Micawber, being now on the eve of casting off the pecuniary shackles that have so long enthralled him, said Mrs. Micawber, and of commencing a new career in a country where there is sufficient range for his abilities, which in my opinion is exceedingly important, Mr. Micawber's abilities peculiarly requiring space, it seems to me that my family should signalise the occasion by coming forward
What I could wish to see would be a meeting between Mr. Micawber and my family at a festive entertainment to be given at my family's expense, where Mr. Micawber's health and prosperity being proposed by some leading member of my family, Mr. Micawber might have an opportunity of developing his views. My dear, said Mr. Micawber with some heat, it may be better for me to state distinctly at once that if I were to develop my views to that assembled group, they would possibly be found of an offensive nature, my impression being that your family are in the aggregate impertinent snobs and in detail unmitigated ruffians. Micawber, said Mrs. Micawber, shaking her head, no, you have never understood them, and they've never understood you. Mr. Micawber coughed. They have never understood you, Micawber, said his wife. They may be incapable of it. If so, that is their misfortune. I can pity their misfortune. I am extremely sorry, my dear Emma, said Mr. Micawber, relenting, to have been betrayed into any expressions that might even remotely have the appearance of being strong expressions. All I would say is that I can go abroad without your family coming forward to favour me. In short, with a parting shove of their cold shoulders, and that, upon the whole, I would rather leave England with such impetus as I possess than derive any acceleration of it from that quarter. At the same time, my dear, if they should condescend to reply to your communications, which our joint experience renders most improbable, far be it from me to be a barrier to your wishes. The matter being thus amicably settled, Mr. Micawber gave Mrs. Micawber his arm, and glancing at the heap of books and papers lying before Traddles on the table, said they would leave us to ourselves, which they ceremoniously did. "My dear Copperfield," said Traddles, leaning back in his chair when they were gone, and looking at me with an affection that made his eyes red and his hair all kinds of shapes, "I don't make any excuse for troubling you with business, because I know you're deeply interested in it, and it may divert your thoughts. My dear boy, I hope you're not worn out." "I'm quite myself," said I, after a pause. "We have more cause to think of my aunt than of anyone. You know how much she's done." "Surely, surely," answered Traddles. "Who can forget it?" "But even that isn't all," said I. "During the last fortnight, some new trouble has vexed her, and she's been in and out of London every day. Several times she's gone out early and been absent until evening. Last night, Traddles, with this journey before her, it was almost midnight before she came home. You know what her consideration for others is. She'll not tell me what's happened to distress her." My aunt, very pale, and with deep lines in her face, sat immovable until I'd finished, when some stray tears found their way to her cheeks, and she put her hand on mine. "It's nothing, Trot, it's nothing. There'd be no more of it. You shall know by and by. Now, Agnes, my dear, let us attend to these affairs." "I must do Mr. Micawber the justice to say," Traddles began, "that although he wouldn't appear to have worked to any good account for himself, he is a most untiring man when he works for other people. I never saw such a fellow. If he always goes on in the same way, he must be virtually about 200 years old at present. The heat into which he has been continually putting himself, and the distracted and impetuous manner in which he's been diving day and night among papers and books, to say nothing of the immense number of letters he's written me between this house and Mr. Wickfield's, and often across the table when he's been sitting opposite and might much more easily have spoken, is quite extraordinary." "Letters!" cried my aunt. "I believe he dreams in letters." "There's Mr. Dick, too," said Traddles, "has been doing wonders. As soon as he was released from overlooking Uriah Heep, whom he kept in such charge as I never saw exceeded, he began to devote himself to Mr. Wickfield. And really his anxiety to be of use in the investigations we've been making, and his real usefulness in extracting and copying and fetching and carrying, have been quite stimulating to us. Dick is a very remarkable man," exclaimed my aunt, "and I always said he was. Trot, you know it." "I'm happy to say, Miss Wickfield," pursued Traddles at once with great delicacy and with great earnestness, "that in your absence Mr. Wickfield has considerably improved. Relieved of the incubus that had fastened upon him for so long a time, and of the dreadful apprehensions under which he had lived, he is hardly the same person.
At times, even his impaired power of concentrating his memory and attention on particular points of business has recovered itself very much, and he's been able to assist us in making some things clear that we should have found very difficult indeed, if not hopeless, without him. But what I have to do is to come to results, which are short enough, not to gossip on all the hopeful circumstances I've observed, or I shall never have done. His natural manner and agreeable simplicity made it transparent that he said this to put us in good heart, and to enable Agnes to hear her father mentioned with greater confidence, but it was not the less pleasant for that. "Now, let me see," said Traddles, looking among the papers on the table. "Having counted our funds and reduced to order a great mass of unintentional confusion in the first place, and of wilful confusion and falsification in the second, we take it to be clear that Mr. Wickfield might now wind up his business and his agency trust and exhibit no deficiency or defalcation whatever."
"Oh, thank heaven!" cried Agnes fervently.
"But," said Traddles, "the surplus that would be left as his means of support, and I suppose the house to be sold, even in saying this, would be so small, not exceeding in all probability some hundreds of pounds, that perhaps, Miss Wickfield, it would be best to consider whether he might not retain his agency of the estate to which he has so long been receiver. His friends might advise him, you know, now he's free. You yourself, Miss Wickfield, Copperfield, I have considered it, Trotwood," said Agnes, looking to me, "and I feel that it ought not to be, and must not be, even on the recommendation of a friend to whom I am so grateful and owe so much."
"I will not say that I recommend it," observed Traddles. "I think it right to suggest it, no more."
"I'm happy to hear you say so," answered Agnes steadily, "for it gives me hope, almost assurance, that we think alike. Dear Mr. Traddles and dear Trotwood, Papa once free with honour, what could I wish for? I've always aspired, if I could have released him from the toils in which he was held, to render back some little portion of the love and care I owe him, and to devote my life to him. It has been for years the utmost height of my hopes. To take our future on myself will be the next great happiness, the next to his release from all trust and responsibility that I can know. Have you thought how, Agnes?"
"Often."
"I'm not afraid, dear Trotwood. I'm certain of success. So many people know me here and think kindly of me that I am certain. Don't mistrust me. Our wants are not many. If I rent the dear old house and keep a school, I shall be useful and happy." The calm fervour of her cheerful voice brought back so vividly first the dear old house itself and then my solitary home, that my heart was too full for speech. Traddles pretended for a little while to be busily looking among the papers. "Next, Miss Trotwood," said Traddles, "that property of yours."
"No, sir," sighed my aunt. "All I've got to say about it is that if it's gone, I can bear it. If it's not gone, I shall be glad to get it back. It was originally, I think, £8,000, consols," said Traddles.
"Right," replied my aunt.
"I can't account for more than five," said Traddles with an air of perplexity.
"Thousand, do you mean?" inquired my aunt, with uncommon composure, "or pounds?"
£5,000, said Traddles.
"It was all there was," returned my aunt. "I sold three myself. One I paid for your articles, Trot, my dear, and the other two I have by me. When I lost the rest, I thought it wise to say nothing about that sum, but to keep it secretly for a rainy day. I wanted to see how you would come out of the trial, Trot, and you came out nobly, persevering, self-reliant, self-denying. So did Dick. Don't speak to me, for I find my nerves a little shaken." Nobody would have thought so, to see her sitting upright with her arms folded, but she had wonderful self-command.
"Then I'm delighted to say," cried Traddles, beaming with joy, "that we've recovered the whole money."
"Don't congratulate me, anybody," exclaimed my aunt.
"How so, sir?"
"'You believed it had been misappropriated by Mr. Wickfield?' said Traddles. "'Of course I did,' said my aunt, "'and was therefore easily silenced. "'Agnes, not a word.' "'And indeed,' said Traddles, "'it was sold, by virtue of the power of management he held from you. "'But I needn't say by whom sold, or on whose actual signature. "'It was afterwards pretended to Mr. Wickfield by that rascal.' And proved, too, by figures, that he had possessed himself of the money on general instructions, he said, to keep other deficiencies and difficulties from the light, Mr. Wickfield being so weak and helpless in his hands as to pay you afterwards several sums of interest on a pretended principle which he knew didn't exist, made himself unhappily a party to the fraud. And at last took the blame upon himself, added my aunt, and wrote me a mad letter, charging himself with robbery and wrong unheard of, upon which I paid him a visit early one morning, called for a candle, burnt the letter, and told him if he ever could write me and himself to do it, and if he couldn't, to keep his own counsel for his daughter's sake. If anybody speaks to me, I'll leave the house. We all remained quiet, Agnes covering her face. Well, my dear friend, said my aunt after a pause, "'And you really extorted the money back from him?' "'Why, the fact is,' returned Traddles, "'Mr. Micawber had so completely hemmed him in, "'and was always ready with so many new points if an old one failed, "'that he couldn't escape from us. "'A most remarkable circumstance is "'that I really don't think he grasped this sum "'even so much for the gratification of his avarice, "'which was inordinate, "'as in the hatred he felt for Copperfield.' He said so to me plainly. He said he would even have spent as much to balk or injure Copperfield. Ha! Said my aunt, knitting her brows thoughtfully and glancing at Agnes. And what's become of him? I don't know. He left here, said Traddles, with his mother, who'd been clamouring and beseeching and disclosing the whole time. They went away by one of the London night coaches, and I know no more about him except that his malevolence to me at parting was audacious. He seemed to consider himself hardly less indebted to me than to Mr. Micawber, which I consider, as I told him, quite a compliment. "'Do you suppose he has any money, Traddles?' I asked. "'Oh, dear, yes, I should think so,' he replied, shaking his head seriously. "'I should say he must have pocketed a good deal in one way or other.' But I think you'd find, Copperfield, if you had an opportunity of observing his course, that money would never keep that man out of mischief. He's such an incarnate hypocrite that whatever object he pursues, he must pursue crookedly. It's his only compensation for the outward restraints he puts upon himself, always creeping along the ground to some small end or other. He will always magnify every object in the way, and consequently will hate and suspect everybody that comes in the most innocent manner between him and it. So the crooked courses will become crookeder at any moment for the least reason or for none. It's only necessary to consider his history here, said Traddles, to know that. He's a monster of meanness, said my aunt. Really, I don't know about that, observed Traddles thoughtfully. Many people can be very mean when they give their minds to it.
This ends side 2 of cassette 24 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 25. David Copperfield, cassette 25.
And now, touching Mr. Micawber, said my aunt. Well, really, said Traddles cheerfully, I must once more give Mr. Micawber high praise. But for his having been so patient and persevering for so long a time, we never could have hoped to do anything worth speaking of. And I think we ought to consider that Mr. Micawber did right for right's sake when we reflect what terms he might have made with Uriah Heep himself for his silence. "'I think so, too,' said I. "'Now, what would you give him?' inquired my aunt. "'Oh, before you come to that,
said Traddles, a little disconcerted. "I'm afraid I thought it discreet to omit, not being able to carry everything before me, 2 points in making this lawless adjustment. Well, it's perfectly lawless from beginning to end of a difficult affair. Those IOUs and so forth, which Mr. Micawber gave him for the advances he had, well, they must be paid," said my aunt. "Yes, but I don't know when they may